Blog Talk Radio.
Sports City Chefs is in the room, cooking up hot topics to put up on your spoon. They well in tune, blown like a flower in June. Superman vs. MF Doom, the clouds loom. So tell a friend, it's the Sports City Chefs again. Pay attention, tune in, we on the set again.
Sports City Chefs.
Yeah. Caps. Ties.
Woo!
Connecticut.
Hello, how you doing today? I hope I find you feeling healthy on this Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. This is Dave here with Nate. Nate, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing just fine, Dave. Happy to be back on for another week of baseball talk with you and everybody out there in the Sports City Chefs listener universe.
It's been quite an interesting week of baseball. We've had a lot going on, some good news, some not so good news. We often gloss over a lot of what happens on the field because there's always so many big stories. So one of which, I'll be honest with you, Nate, I came in here today excited to talk about the Yermin Mercedes situation. And for anybody who doesn't know, he was basically a lifer in lower ball in the minors and then finally came up and had quite an interesting stretch a few months ago, which included swinging at a 3-0 pitch in a blowout. And that is where you may have heard his name before, but you'll hear his name again because he basically quit. I mean, there's no other way to put it. He calls it retired. I think that's it's in the eye of the beholder. If you want to say he quit versus he stayed, or versus he quit versus he retired. So that's quite an interesting little storyline. One thing I will touch on a little bit later is a situation that happened at Nationals Park in the last week, an unfortunate situation. And it's something I do want to talk about, sports and the context of events like that. But before we dive into all the serious topics, let me just give anybody listening a quick run around the scoreboard. Right now, the Yankees are ahead of the Red Sox, 1-0, but they are in a rain delay on the top of the fifth. And in that game, we have Jordan Montgomery facing Tanner Houck as the starting pitchers. Atlanta and Philly right now, Atlanta's up 6-0 in the top of the seventh, getting the start in that game was Charlie Morton against Matt Moore for Philly. Both of those teams very close in the NL East. The Braves are 46-48. The Phillies aren't even 500 with the Braves at 46-48. Give me one second here, Nate.
Yep. I will pick up while you're gone there. Bottom six, Cleveland leading Tampa Bay. The Cleveland Indians for now they're still the Cleveland Indians at 48-45. Tampa sitting at 57-39. So that one looks to be going the way of Cleveland. Bottom five in down south in Miami. The Padres were up 3-0 on the Marlins. Ian Snell getting the start for the Padres and just doing what he does, cruising right along.
Miami only has one hit in that game, by the way, Nate.
Yes, you're right. They do. And I will send it back over to you to pick up with the Cubs in St. Louis.
Thank you. The Cubs in St. Louis right now in the bottom of the sixth, the Cubs are down 2-3. St. Louis also at 548-48. The Chicago Cubs 47-49, which is very interesting to see how the Cubs pursue the rest of the season. Are they sellers? Are they buyers? A lot of interesting trade stuff to talk about. The Los Angeles Shohei Ohtani, whatever you want to call them, Angels, are zip-zip against the Twins, who are in the news today, trading away Nelson Cruz. So I think that's a bigger story coming out of that game. It's two teams I don't really see doing a whole lot, although The Angels are hanging in there at 46 and 48, and they are going to get Mike Trout back at some point, so who knows. And then we got a couple games going on later tonight. We have Oakland Athletics, who are 55, 42, and potentially homeless, against the Seattle Mariners, who are 51 and 45. That game at T-Mobile Park in where the Mariners play. And then on the West Coast still, we have the Giants facing the Dodgers in L.A. You've got Anthony DeSclafani against Walker Buehler, the great Walker Buehler, Nate's favorite player. Though both of those last two will start right as we close. So a lot of good, interesting matchups in baseball. I got to admit, I'm buying into the Walker Buehler hype, by the way. I know he's – I make that comment because I know Nate thinks that Walker Buehler is overrated. But I don't know, man. 10-1 with a 2.3 ERA that's what you want. And if you're looking for a pitcher, I'd take that. Actually, I think just taking a glance right now, Nate, I'm just looking at all the starting pitchers today who went out on the bump for their teams. Now, DeSclafani and Buehler both have 10 wins each, and that's the only matchup even close to that right now. Of all the other pitchers who started today, Charlie Morton's 8-3, but that's it. There's really nobody else with really a whole lot of wins. Chris Flexen for Seattle's is 9-3, but really Walker Buehler. My point is, Nate, Walker Buehler is the guy today. When you look at all the guys who are starting and say, who do I want? Who is my favorite pitcher today? It's the great Walker Buehler, and I just need to make sure I point that out.
I'm going to roll the Snell bandwagon a little bit there. He's going. He's cruising for San Diego, trying to get that ERA back down to a quality start, 4.5, if you can keep this up, maybe, a few more innings, get it down from 4.92.
So, yeah, I mean, let me ask you, Nate. I know it's a question I think we've kind of touched on before, but just a real quick side question before we really dive into anything. If you're going to a game, would you rather be in a game where you're going, let's go with the seventh inning. You're heading into the seventh inning. It's a 2-2 game. So you're not really facing a situation where somebody's going to get a shutout, but it's a close game and you know every pitch matters. Would you rather do something like that? Or would you rather be at a game where it's 13-13 and both teams are deep into the bullpen, and instead of seeing a great pitching matchup, you're trying to see who would win the war of attrition? So, you know, I think the way a 2-2 game versus a, you know, 13-13 game are two very different situations. So I'm curious, what would you want to see as a fan at the ballpark, not on TV, at the ballpark?
You're absolutely right. They are two very, very different things. And I think the environment when you're at the ballpark, just the electricity that's feeding around the ballpark, I still think that I go for the 2-2 pitcher's duel just because it's better baseball. Like, you're getting good pitching. You presumably have some good hitting in there, either, you know, a timely RBI, maybe a home run.
Right. Good point.
I don't like the idea of going out there and seeing Matt Harvey getting pulled in the third inning. That's not entertaining to me. I don't like the – I don't know that I would ever pay to actually watch the Tampa Bay Rays in person because I don't want to see the bullpen game where the guy's getting yanked in the third inning and then we got to bring in six other guys, because I think that's one of the things that slows the game down, is that you're always going to the next pitcher up.
Do you think they should have some type of roster restrictions to prevent situations like that?
I don't know that I'd go that far. I would like to see a bit of a shift in how some of these managers approach games like this. So I've had this discussion with some Oriole fan friends a couple of times. Brandon Hyde had, you know, the Orioles are bad. Everybody knows the Orioles are bad. And there are so many games where, you know, Jorge Lopez is on the mound or Matt Harvey's on the mound. So you know the game is over by the fourth inning because they're already down 5 or 6-0. And there are guys in their pen that can cover like between two and four innings. But instead of letting these guys go out and just cover four innings, Braden Hyde goes out and he's like, okay, you're going to give me one, you're going to give me one, you're going to give me one. And at the end of the day, you look at the Orioles box score and they've gone through six pitchers. Well, now what are you going to do for the rest of the week, dude? You got, like, these guys, some of them can pitch back-to-back, but most of them probably can't. Like, I'd like to see a bit of a shift from some of these managers where they basically either tell the starter, you're going out and you're throwing six or seven innings. I don't care what your pitch count is. I don't care how many runs you give up. I just need you to cover it and let them do it. Or if you're going to yank the starter early, roll the bullpen guy out there and be like, I need five. I don't care what happens. The game's over. Like, just give me five. You got to save me.
What? Why? Why do you need that? What's wrong with a team one day having, let's go with nine pitchers, right? And every day one of those pitchers could go three innings. And you just kind of keep swapping them through so that way nobody goes through the rotation multiple times. And every so often, every one of those arms can be used situationally. What's wrong with that?
So you're saying you like in your hypothetical, we're limiting a pitching staff to nine guys?
Yes.
I don't think there's anything
I'm sorry.
With that.
And what I'm saying is don't view this as here's your group of starters and here's your group of relievers. Don't look at it like that. What I'm saying is, and maybe 10 or 11 is a safer number, but you start with nine pitchers. Each one of them gives you a run through the rotation, and you put together, you know, 360. You put three games together back to back to back, but none of them are throwing hypothetically more than three innings. I mean, what's to say that's not a valid roster construction?
And I mean, you have teams that do it. The Rays do it more. I feel the Rays do it more than anybody. Although I'd need to look at the stats to see how often they do it, but that is a thing that they say. And you know, there are managers that basically say like, hey, today's going to be a bullpen day. I only have four starters available. We're rolling into the fifth, we're rolling into day five or day six without a break. And I need to throw somebody out there. We're going to empty out the bullpen today. So like they do that, it happens. And you could construct your roster with that in mind. It would be a great way to keep your costs down because you're not paying $10, $15, $20 million to that pitcher that you need to go out there and that you're relying on to go out and give you six, and he ends up giving you four. But from a baseball, like from a league perspective, if the league is really going to be committed to this, we need to increase pace of play. We need to get people more interested. The more times you go to the bullpen, the more downtime you're just injecting into the game, because every time that guy comes out, he gets his, what is it, nine warm-up pitches. And you know, you have your pitch clock and your warm-up clock and the inning change. And I could see where they would think that it's a good thing in terms of, you know, the more times you go to the bullpen, the more ad revenue you get from commercial breaks. But for the people that are in the stands, you're really just crushing the pace of play. You're just creating a whole lot more downtime.
So right now, though, baseball as a sport is built and the rules are constructed where you have a starting pitcher and then whoever can't finish the job kind of closes it up. I mean, even in the 80s and to a point the 90s, you didn't even really have like a true closer. I mean, you know, you would have a starter and then your second pitcher. So in a weird way, I'm kind of almost getting closer to that. But if you assume the adaptation of the game moves in a way like I'm talking about, why wouldn't you move? I don't want to blame the physical location of the bullpen right now, but I might be about to. But, like, what if you're able to just, once a pitcher's done, you cycle him out, you throw someone else right in there. There's no, almost like no downtime. Think of it mentally. Don't worry about the execution, but mentally, no different than a line change in hockey.
Yeah, I get what you're driving at. I don't know that it's really feasible unless you were to ban the mid-inning pitching change. So your hypothetical could work if we're basically saying that every pitcher that if you were a pitcher that steps on the mound, you're finishing the inning come hell or high water. You cannot be relieved like after two
well,
outs
no.
and you're kill.
Well, no, no, no. What I'm saying is okay. So you get through the first two batters. And I mean, this is what I'm talking is completely, it might be hard to, it's hard for me to wrap my head around, but you're through the first two batters, your third guy is fouled off like 5-6 pitches. And then your manager yells line change, pitcher on there runs off, new pitcher runs on and throws the next pitch almost seamlessly. The point of what I'm saying, like, I know it's somewhat unrealistic, but if you think of it from a fan standpoint, what you're doing fundamentally isn't changing the game. All you're doing is changing the pace. And if you can prepare players for something like that, I don't know. It just seems like exciting. And I've been trying to think, Nate, the reason I went down this road is I've been trying to think about why it's so boring. And I didn't intend to go down this road. But, Nate, I think it's no secret that the reason baseball is losing a lot of viewership is because to many people's eyes it's boring. So I know you're a football fan. I know you're a soccer fan. You're a good sports fan. You understand all of it. And you look at the king of sports right now, football, right? What's the least interesting thing in football? It's a one-yard draw play. Where you just, you know, take three steps back into the running back and he runs right into the offensive line. So,
and yet everybody runs that every freaking
football. But even in football, that 1 yard draw play is pretty boring, right? But it's still more exciting than you know, a 97 mile an hour fastball in the outside corner. It just is. And I think that's part of the problem. So if you say a batter gets, you know, 5 pitches in at bat, and then you kind of extrapolate that over the course of a game, you say you'll see 250 pitches. Right now, I'm telling you, Nate, if you look at one baseball game and there's 250 pitches, let's just go with that number because it's easy. How many times out of those 250 pitches, do you expect to see something interesting? And what I mean by interesting is it's either a home run or something to advance a runner on base. And as a Yankee fan, I can confidently say you're pretty much only looking for the home run. But I want to be understanding that there are teams who constructed other than the Yankees who are actually what I guess maybe trying to move runners over. But I'm thinking like, how many times are you getting something significantly worse than the 1 yard draw play?
Well, you know, for your question, it's a good thing that you defined interesting because otherwise you're asking the wrong guy because I'm the guy that sits here and watches the game and I'm like, oh, wow, what a nasty curveball. Or like, I'm the guy that watches, like, you know, I watch the pitcher throw changeup, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, okay, come on, buzz him up and in, and, you know, I'm trying to call the next pitch, but I'm not the guy that you're thinking about in this situation. You're thinking about the average
casual
the casual fan who isn't necessarily paying attention to 90% of the game. They're on their, you know, they're on their phone waiting to get hit in the face with the baseball because they're not paying attention kind of thing. Out of those, that never happens. There's only like 4 pending lawsuits in the city of Chicago right now. Don't worry about it. out of those 250 pitches, how often are you going to see something exciting like ball in play to move a runner over, maybe a stolen base, home run?
Stolen base. Oh, my God, that's hilarious, a stolen base. I've seen a stolen base in 76, and I was born in 84, my friend.
Well, that's because you watched the Yankees.
True. Well,
let's say 33, let's say a third of the pitches, maybe, if that, 20, like somewhere between 20 and 30%.
Now, again,
if I'm just like, if I'm going completely empirically and just guessing.
See, now, I find it interesting, and this is something I'm going to look at over the next week, because it's just a thought that popped into my head today. So I didn't have a chance to really dive into the stats, but let's just assume that because neither of us have any statistics in front of us, this is a purely emotional argument. So you're saying a third of the pitches? I don't.
Pitches.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm talking individual pitches.
Right. That's I'm saying a third of those will be put in play.
Okay. So that 20, let's just do 25% of 250 is 62.5. So I'll give you an extra one. Let's say it's 63 pitches. You're saying 63 pitches result in something that advances the game forward and in a way either results in an out, a base runner, or a base runner advancing. That's really it.
Well, okay. Well, that's,
I shouldn't
that's
say
interesting.
Out. I'm sorry.
If we're going to say advancing the game forward, because now you got to add in the strikeout, so we can up that closer to 50.
A significantly larger number. I also think the strikeout is just not nearly as cool as it was. The strikeout is the ho-hum thing. I used to love watching like a guy like Roger Clemens or Randy Johnson just mow guys down. But now it's not as fun anymore. I feel like that 63 is way high.
Well, you know, the strikeout that I look forward to, though, is the one where you just completely fool the batter. And you just have the guy, like, down to one knee, flailing with two arms, like, swinging at the ball in the other batter's box.
Oh, I would love watching guys look like fools against the Barry Zito curve when that was like a really big deal. That was the greatest.
Yep. Or the Wakefield knuckleball. You don't know where that's going, so you're just like, okay, I'm gonna.
Tim Wakefield is the definition of one of those guys. He was a guy in a team I hate, like the Anchorman quote. But damn it, I hate you. But damn it, I respect you.
Yep.
There's just something about a good knuckleball, and you just don't see it much anymore. I remember R.A. Dickey had a stretch there for a while where he was all world, it felt like. But it was something that popped into my head. I'm really, really glad I got to grab your thoughts. I got a caller on the line here, though, Nate, and I want to see if we can get some thoughts from our caller.
Hey, what's up, guys? Good night to join you.
What's going on?
It's Mike. Hey, man, I was just listening to your commentary, and the one thing, I guess Phil Negro was probably that for the previous generation too, right? That knuckleballer that just found a way to win.
Yeah, great call.
So, but to your point about examples of making guys like, that's what made a guy like in his prime, Johan Santana, so exciting to watch, because people would just flail at that bug. They called it Bugs Bunny changeup for a reason, right? And Pedro Martinez could look people look that way sometimes too.
Pedro's
like,
changeup,
but that's what made it so
one fun. Of the best pitches.
Yeah, and the gas that he threw, just like the gas that came off Johan's left arm. It was entertaining, right, to watch.
Yeah, and let's not shortchange Eric Gagne and his changeup either.
No, I mean, that's what makes it fun, and you're right. The strikeout has definitely lost a lot of its luster because of this whole swing for the fences, launch angle, strikeout tie. Game that we've turned into now.
Well, the counter is true as well. It's also a power pitcher's game. Any guy who comes out of the bullpen, you just assume, really, if say you're at a bar and you're not watching the game, you look up for a second, I'm half paying attention to this game, a guy's coming out, if he starts chucking at a 97, 98, you're going to be like, all right, it's a relief pitcher. It's not interesting anymore, but it's still hard as hell to hit if you're a batter.
The relief pitchers, the only ones that really struggle that come out, because they're all power arms, and the ones that are struggling, you can look at the numbers. The whip's high, the walks are high, the getting behind in counts and that kind of thing. It's a lack of control more than a lack of stuff now from people coming out of the pen if they're not succeeding.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
Could you imagine
Greg
Maddux in today's game?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, could you imagine
Greg Maddux? Carve people up.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
And his strikeout numbers would have been a lot higher, even though he couldn't break wind with his fastball, right? Because because people's swings were, people weren't worried about plate coverage as much now. And all those up angles, and people understand how precise he even knew then, even when people's swings were diverse. Like a story of one time, they came into the mound, he told Jeff Blauser, on the third pitch I throw, I want you to take three steps to your left, he's going to hit right at you. He said, what, not the next pitch? He said, no, I got to set it up. He's going to foul one pitch off. He's going to either take one or foul the second one off, and then the third pitch is coming right to you. Jeff Blauser was like, sure as shit. I took two steps over. On the third pitch, it came right to me. I didn't have to move.
That's unbelievable. I've never heard that story. That's great. That sounds like something he would do, too. It's something I think that's almost lost in the game is when CC Sabathia, for instance, when he first came over to the Yankees, he still had a bit of an arm, but he learned, they always say he learned how to pitch. And I thought that was such a lazy phrase when I was younger. And the same thing was true with a guy like Clemens. I mean, growing up, even before I was, really able to be a true baseball fan, he was Rocket. But when I watched him as a Yankee, he wasn't really Rocket. He was a guy who he had a good splitter, and I get it. I understand he was taking performance enhancing drugs or whatever he was doing. But the point is it's more what they used to do with pitchers was they would take the power arms and then teach them how to really get good control. I think even a guy like Curt Schilling is an example of some power guy who really was able to stand it up. Now, I don't know how you take some of these power pitchers right now and you just expect them to really learn the control to keep them savvy. Like, I'm trying to think of Nate. Tell me, who's a guy who you can think of who is just a flamethrower but was able to revitalize his career? I mean, nobody's as versatile as, say, a John Smoltz. John Smoltz was, in a way, like an Ohtani before Ohtani, being able to switch between starter and reliever, but... is there anybody that kind of jumps out who's been versatile at a pitcher like that? And thank you for the call, by the way. We really appreciate when you guys call in. Just in case you guys don't know, the number to call in is 929-477-2759. Always appreciate anybody who calls in. And that was, of course, one of our best callers. But, Nate, I want to know your answer on the pitchers.
Off the top of my head, I can't come up with somebody that went from – power to finesse. Well, I mean, modern day, not a whole lot.
Yeah, modern day.
Say, yeah, I was gonna say, I just recently. Well, so Verlander's interesting because he's still a power guy, but he went he just decided that he's not gonna really pull it up until he gets into late innings. So like, he will hit 100, or at least he used to be able to hit 100, but for the first three innings, you could. He was going to top out at like 93 because he would go like 70%. And then as he
had
moved
to learn
along,
that lesson the hard way.
His own, yeah, it became his own.
He had to learn that lesson the hard way because of how deep his teams went so many years. And he wasn't, he was kind of gassed the next year. I think, like, to your point, a little bit out of Smoltz, even though he still had some fire, but he kind of, became a little finesse. There's at least one or two more. Give me a second, and I'll come up with them as we continue tonight. But there's at least one or two more, but there's not many, that have relearned basically how to pitch and be successful.
Yeah, I mean, the guys that I was going to go with were Juan Marichal and Lawrence Spahn, but that's not modern day. Those are old guys. Those are really old guys that, like, they learned how to – and, you look at – I highly recommend that book to everybody, especially, Dave, you're talking about, like, you thought that the idea of the, quote, learning how to pitch was kind of lazy. You read books like The Greatest Game Ever Pitched, where it talks about the 16-game or the 16-inning 1-0 duel between Marichal and Spahn back in the 60s, 70s. I forget the date. I want to say it was 62, but it might have been 72. I have to double-check that. Anyway.
Oh,
you read
I got
book
you a guy.
And it just goes all the way through. It's fantastic. Go ahead.
I got you a guy. Bartolo Colon.
Big sexy.
Because Bartolo,
I love it.
But when people forget, when he first came up with Cleveland, he was throwing gas. I mean, sheer gas. And as he got older, he didn't have that same luster in his arm. And CC Sabathia, another guy who was grew up with the Cleveland organization. But CC Sabathia in the same way. CC Sabathia was winning late in his career with smoke and mirrors, basically.
Bartolo Colon needs to be signed. He needs a contract in the major leagues because he is killing it in the Mexican league right now.
So I just decided to take a quick look at the oldest by age active players. And in terms of pitchers, right now you got Rich Hill, who's 41. And how about this one? Second, so Albert Pujols is the oldest. Then by pitcher, it would be Rich Hill. Then after that would be Adam Wainwright. But Nelson Cruz is right in there. That was interesting. But we have Nelson Cruz right there, who's one of the oldest pitchers. J.A. Happ is 38. You got a number of guys who are 30. And I'm looking at the list and trying to see here who is kind of your more flamethrower types. I mean, you got Darren O'Day, never a flamethrower. Irvin Santana, never a flamethrower. Verlander, I definitely think, was the kind of guy who had an arm. And then you're looking at, like, Zach Greinke and Charlie Morton, who I'm kind of surprised he's this old. But there's, you know, guys, I don't really see anybody other than the ones that we brought up who's a flamethrower. And I don't know if there's anybody right now that I think of as a starter who's a flamethrower that can really reinvent themselves. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting thought. Now, Mike, I have a question for you.
What
is your take on the Yermán Mercedes retirement and then comeback that he posted on his Instagram today, that, you know, he said he apologized for what he did and he loves baseball and that he's back? I'd love to hear your take because you call in. I know you're a good baseball fan, and from a true baseball fan, I'd love your thoughts.
No, you just wonder, like, so I think baseball more than any other out of the major sports, baseball, like, really humbles you, right? Like, the only game that comes close to humbling you the way baseball does probably is golf, and that's not one of the major three sports, you know, in America that we talk about, right? Like, it gets tough, but I don't know. Like, who knows what was going on in his head? Did he have some conflict with somebody? Has he not been hitting well? Has he been struggling? Is he still, you know, mad that he got sent down even though he wasn't hitting very well? You just never know what was going on. You wonder if it's kind of a – you wonder if it was almost just him throwing a fit by making this announcement and just trying to see. You know, we've all heard that sometimes that person that cries wolf just to kind of see what kind of response you get or whatever. And he's like – people start reaching out, and he's like, well, shit, maybe I'm actually needed. So he decides to – you know, he decides to hang around or tough it out or kind of backtrack. I think he just let his emotions get the best of him. And I think what you saw, unfortunately, is not going to be as much of an outlier as it has been up until now. And that is sometimes people expressing their immediate emotions on social media, and a lot of times they get raked over the coals for it. But I think he just threw a little bit of a temper tantrum and made a decision. Maybe even that Latina temper or whatever got the best of him. But, you know, I don't know. I can't. You can call it a retirement. I can call it kind of quitting baseball. The guy hasn't really put together a legitimate enough career yet for me to be, oh, a big retirement announcement, you know?
No, I totally understand. I'm just wondering, too. That's interesting thoughts. Now, say you're his teammate. I mean, how would you feel if you were his teammate? Do you think he quit on you, or do you say, listen, man, this guy's going through a tough time. He needs us. You know, I think that's just one of the interesting things that, you know, I could – 10 years ago, even maybe in 15, 20, the immediate reaction would be, dude, suck it up. Like, you're playing baseball. I would imagine would be the knee-jerk reaction then. But now I just think, yeah, with such an emphasis, you know, and rightfully so, on mental health and everything, it does give me a little pause to wonder, you know. I'll admit, first word that came to my mind was, just like you, Mike, was temper tantrum. But, you know, at the same time, you hope that somebody in that situation gets, you know, figures out kind of what they want. I mean, he's 28, right? I believe he's 28. I don't know about you guys. I thought I knew what I wanted when I was in my early 20s. Definitely didn't. When I got to my later 20s, I started to figure out, maybe this guy is realizing, hey, I did it. I made it to the show, and now I'm back down here. Was that my flash in the pan?
Yeah, and I think you look at, like, he's already done more than most people would have gone into baseball. I mean, not, you know, you just look at the sheer numbers in the minor leagues versus how many make the majors, and maybe he's starting to be discouraged. To your point, as far as a teammate, you know, I mentioned John Smoltz earlier, but I think back to in his Hall of Fame speech, he said when he walked in the clubhouse as a kid, when he went, he had just got drafted, and he got to hang out with the Tigers major league team, and he said that Alan Trammell taught him how to be a professional because he was at the top of his stardom at the time. And Alan Trammell walked over to him, and he said, "Nice to meet you, kid." And he said, "Whatever you need, just reach out to me. I got you." He said, "Remember, this house is your house." And he and John Smoltz said from that point on, like, Alan Trammell taught him what was needed and how to be a professional to stop and even speak to a rookie like that and do that. And so there's at least some guys in a good clubhouse, and they got enough veterans on that team that are going to walk up and say something like that to him. And at the same time, regardless of whatever's going on and off, as an athlete too, I can tell you that regardless of what happened when people were at school or between the lines when they come to practice or whatever, or they're on the field with us or whatever, they're part of our team, and we're just going to do everything we can to pick them up and not even worry about it, because we can't do anything about it, and we're not going to – anything other than supporting him is just going to be detrimental to our team anyway.
That's a really good point from an inside the locker room.
Well, and I think that's kind of what happened in this case, because I was reading that Tony La Russa, his manager, is a big supporter of his. I'm pretty sure that, you know, when he made the announcement yesterday that he was stepping away from baseball, they asked La Russa and in the front office of the White Sox, like, "Hey, have you heard about this?" And they were all like, "Well, you know, we saw the Instagram post, but we really haven't heard anything more. We haven't talked to him yet." And La Russa flat out said, "I'm going to call him and give him a call, like, talk to him," because he's a big supporter of his. And to your point about, you know, having the great guys around the locker room, as much as I really don't like Tony La Russa, it's hard to find a guy that's been around baseball longer and has more experience in the game than Tony La Russa. So if there's a guy that's going to be able to pick you up and teach you how to be a professional within the game, Tony La Russa is about the best as you can possibly get. He is a manager instead of a player, but, you know, he can basically fill in that role for the White Sox.
Let me ask you a question. You were talking about books, and I promise I'll get back after this. I'm not trying to take over anything. But, like, you were talking about books. Have any of you guys read La Russa's book?
I have not read La Russa's book yet. I read a book where he was extensively interviewed. I read Men at Work by George Will, where there's an entire section devoted just to Tony La Russa when he was back managing the Oakland Athletics back in 1988. But I haven't read La Russa's book that he authored himself.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it off my head, but I read it, and it was very good. It's definitely worth the read. It gave some insight into a lot of different parts and times in his life and ups and downs and whatever. I mean, you know, as somebody mentioned the way you guys were talking about enjoying books and enjoying, you know, sports-related stuff, I would say that it is definitely worth the read.
For anyone interested, the name of the book is called One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball, 10 and a Half Games Back, and One Final Champion Season. And for what it's worth, folks, this was released in 2012, and again, it's called One Last Strike, 50 Years in Baseball. That's the Tony La Russa book that he penned. Also available via audiobook if you're like me and you like a good old audiobook.
And didn't Francona write one too?
Probably. I think everybody in baseball has now at least gotten a book. Every manager who's won a World Series probably is, like, obligated to write a book.
As a kid, I loved books like that. About, like, I was always running around outside doing all kinds of different things, so it was hard to get me to, like, sit down and read books the way I do as an adult. Like, but that was what got me interested as much as anything was sports books.
That's
like autobiographies and stuff. And it's so much fun, mm-hmm, to see some of them now that I can recall all the things, because as a child, I read the Mickey Mantle books and the Lou Gehrig's and the Babe
awesome.
Ruth's and all the books I could get my hands on. And listen, I soaked it up. I jotted down names. I looked up references and things like that. As you know, that, but I learned about guys and learned about the history of the game from what I read. Right. And to get into a generation now where these guys are writing autobiographies or biographies covering several decades in the sport, and, you know, 99% of the names that are mentioned that are related to the game I recognize and whatever. It's an interesting dynamic, right? But it's fun.
It's really cool. I
Don Baylor
is
another
I read,
I think of.
I can't say I've read nearly as many of the books as you guys have. When I was a kid, I was a little bit of a nerd, and I would read the stats pages and, you know, the New York Times. Like, I used to remember waking up and grabbing the box scores out of that. The ESPN Almanac.
I could memorize lineups, man. Or, like, sometimes I get my dad
yeah.
to grab the box score. My dad would grab the box score, and he'd say, okay, here's the teams or whatever. And I'd say, okay, away team, and I would try to guess their lineups, like their exact batting orders and stuff. Like,
good
I
luck
remember
doing
playing
that
game
today.
Even at 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you can't do it today. But it was fun back then.
Oh, yeah. It was also, I think, a lot easier because they would run the same guys out every night. Now you buy a ticket and you don't know.
Yeah, and the platoons were more – guys were in certain spots, but you knew, like – you knew if it was against the Cardinals in the Whitey Herzog days, if it was a right-handed pitcher on the mound, Kurt Ford was probably going to play right field. But if it was a left-handed pitcher, it was probably going to be somebody like Jim Lindemann. Like, you knew that before it even came out. You saw the order enough times that you could probably just about nail it.
I remember before the internet trying to come up with – see, I would also try to figure out the rotations. So I would write out, like, kind of try to figure out, like, how often each guy was pitching and then figure out every team's five-man rotation. So it's funny. That was, for me, my version of those books. I loved those probably in the same way you enjoyed the books. But I think the books really do give you an intimate – look at it. And it does make me a little worried in a way. Like, I'm wondering who's playing ball right now that's, you know, probably in their 20s, maybe not so much the guys in their 30s, but who's going to be the next player to, you know, write a cool book? It would be cool to see what, you know, would love to see what Shohei thinks of all of this meteoric rise and, you know, what feels like the summer of Shohei Ohtani, even though the team is, you know, two games or a game under 500. And Trout is not even playing.
Ichiro will write one at some point. That'll be one that comes out. But as far as in their 20s, I bet you that you will see at least one or two of those current Blue Jays write a book. And they'll also be able to tell about their stories in the clubhouses as a kid watching their dads compete.
Oh, that
guys they remember from that time,
yeah.
too. But I think if, like, Kevin Biggio, for example, is a guy, I think.
Well, Dave, you know who I'm going to throw out there. I'm fanboying hard on this one. You
Trey?
Know exactly whose name I'm throwing. There you go. I want to hear all about his story, fighting and coming back and still being a dominant force.
Who are you talking about?
Man, if
Trey Mancini.
Oh, yeah, I love that, yeah. I think that and then, you know, some up and downs. Like, I think, you know, if Vlad Jr. ever were to write a book at some point, probably the second language it was in, but as a fluent Spanish speaker, if it did get released in Spanish first, I'd read it. In Spanish before I read it in English, but because think of all the different things he would have experienced as a kid with his dad too, from going to Montreal to bouncing around other places.
That's
too.
What I was thinking, the Montreal,
yeah,
part of it too.
That would be fantastic. Another guy that I hope sooner rather than later, once he retires, I'd like to see Dusty Baker write something.
That's a good one. He seems like the kind of guy who would too.
How about Rossi?
David Ross?
Manager?
Yeah.
I'd love to read David Ross is,
yeah.
you know, the catcher for the Red Sox and the Cubs when they break their – when they snap their streak. So he won in both of them, and now he gets to spend time managing the Cubs. I'd read that book.
Yeah, and he came up – and he also spent time with the Dodgers and saw kind of what that burden was like on that franchise too. Like, no, I think that's a good one. It's interesting to see, like There's a lot of guys out there that have recently stepped away too. There's certain guys that, like, I just hope they write something before they die. I'll give you one other example that I would have loved to have seen a book come from, but he didn't live long enough. But you guys, at least one of you will probably know this name, but Pete Van Waring was in the Braves broadcast booth for years. He was skipping Pete in the Braves broadcast booth. But Pete was kind of a professor type guy, like that kind of background. And so he called baseball for many, many years and was a historian of the game or whatever. And obviously with that team for that many years, bounced around and saw a lot of different guys and influences. It would have been interesting to see him write something.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, I got a quick question for you. I want to shift really quickly, just because you've been a good caller, and I like getting your thoughts on things, too. What did you watch the Home Run Derby, and what did you think of it?
You know, they hit a lot of home runs in that thing. it was exciting. I nailed a couple of the lower seeds, went in. I think it's actually, believe it or not, I think it's good for Pete Alonso in some ways, and not bad for baseball that Pete Alonso won. I mean, the last full season, what, he hits 50 home runs or whatever, you know, so he leads in home runs, and then this is the second home run derby in a row that he's won. Like, it now gives you somebody to come for as well next year. It gives you another angle. I don't know that, you know, I don't know that they really did enough to really feature and build the profiles of these guys. Like we talked about, you know, before the All-Star game, a week or two above before the All-Star game when I was on here with you guys. But I thought that, like, the actual product on the field and the way it ran and, like, the talent that you saw and the power hitting that you saw, I thought that it was fun. And I thought that it was a decent showpiece for baseball.
That is an interesting point.
None of it's going to matter if we have a player strike next year.
Yeah, I'm worried about that. But to the actual night itself, and I walked away very surprised that I had as much fun watching it. Although I feel like saying I'm very surprised about it is something I say every year, sort of like, I'm so excited for the Hall of Fame game preseason football game. And then 3 minutes in, not even 3 minutes, in 3 seconds, and I'm like, well, this is dumb. Yeah, exactly. I mean, why am I doing this? I just wanted to hear the opening theme song. But, you know, with the All-Star game, both the All-Star game, really, and the Derby, yeah, they didn't really showcase the personalities. It would have been cool to do a little, like, piece on the players when they take the time out or something like that. And I get it. You got to sell the ad space. And it is funny that they did such a good job with the actual product, I think. I think they did such a good job with the product. But, yeah, they didn't do the one thing that they really had a huge opportunity to do, which is build stars. I mean, they just put Shohei in front of you so much and in the right time slots that he became the storyline, it felt like. But, yeah, I do love this growing star of Pete Alonso, but I need more of Pete Alonso. Man, him, Mike, I said it last week, but him dancing and swinging away, that was the coolest thing ever. That was just cool.
And he's a big dude. It kind of brings you back to the panda days, right, of, like, Pablo Sandoval, like, in big moments, the way he would kind of cut up when he was leading San Francisco to even year championships for a couple of climbs through, even after he went back. But that, and then, I don't know, I think just also, like, you think about the story that Shohei was, but the other one that really sticks out to me is, like, I think that it helped other people, even though he was on their World Series team, but people that might have forgotten, it helped raise Juan Soto's profile, too, right? Like, it was a good night for him. And how cool that we were able to feature Mancini in some of his stories for a lot of this derby and still have him talk about and be that relevant all the way down to the end. Like, that's a great feel-good story, too. So there were a lot of elements in place there that made it good.
No, it was certainly a lot of fun. And Mike, listen, I'm glad you called back. It looks like we had a little bit of a technical issue at one point there, and you dropped off. But always good to hear from you. We really appreciate you calling in. Call in next week, and thank you for being a good listener, Mike. We're gonna say goodnight to you at this point as Nate and I take it down the ninth inning here. But good talking to you, man.
Hey, real quick before you guys wrap up, much respect to the Timeless and all the Sports City chefs and all you guys. I'm in on the brunch and other things, and I definitely appreciate you guys having me around.
Yo, we love it, man. Keep calling Sports City Chefs, the whole network. We're a family. All right, Nate. I want to take a moment here as we wrap up to talk about some other things, specifically the trade deadline. You know, the biggest news that came out earlier today was that Nelson Cruz is on the move. And I don't know, does it – Do you feel like Nelson Cruz going from the Twins to the Rays, how big of a deal do you think that is? Because, you know, Nelson Cruz is obviously a good, he's a great player. I mean, this year he's got 19 home runs, hitting just under 300. So I think that's really attractive for that team. I mean, if you keep moving guys around the bases with a guy like Nelson Cruz who can DH, that's good. How much of a factor do you think he'll be for that team?
I actually kind of think it's a weird move in a way, because the Rays, the way that they're just built, like their roster construction is, they do have that element of moving guys around the bases. They're not all, you know, home run or nothing. Like, they do have guys that are going to put the ball in play and play to take up extra base. But they strike out a lot. They do rely on a lot of home runs. And, you know, now you're adding in Nelson Cruz, where his biggest feature is his bat. You can't really play him anywhere defensively. You could technically put him in the outfield, but you really, like, at his age, you're not going to put him in the outfield on that carpet that they play on down in Tampa. And they already had some pretty solid DH options. It's another bat. Another bat is never going to hurt. I didn't think that their offense was hurting, so it's kind of a weird move for me. And I also just don't like that now the Orioles have to face him, I think, 9 more times. I don't know how many times we've played the Rays already, but you know, you play everybody 18 times. Let's assume we've played half of them since we're halfway through the year. I don't want to have to face the guy that, you know, carried us into the postseason in 2014 and took us to the precipice of something that we, you know, one of the best seasons we ever had. I don't like having to face him more often now, but I just, from a purely baseball standpoint, I kind of scratched my head on it. They did get a prospect. They got a catching prospect in the deal as well. And I think they sent 2 pitchers out, which means that those pitchers probably aren't going to be any good because they're now leaving Tampa's organization before they can get up. But
so, all right, here's the thing I'll say is, if you look at Austin Meadows, who's largely been the DH for the Rays so far this year, they both have similar amounts of plate appearances. Nelson Cruz got 346 and Meadows has 385. So there's a good sample size for both, right? At this point, Meadows does have 10 more runs, but Cruz has him with, mind you, 40-ish less plate appearances. He's got 7 more hits. He's got 3 more home runs. He doesn't have as many ribbies, but I also, you know, got to look at the lineup there. And the batting average difference is 294 to 240. So I think if you look at, like you said, the roster construction of the Rays, they are really, I think, trying to fill in those gaps where they can move players around. I mean, you look at the team they've got right now. Like I said, Meadows has 16 home runs, but you have Brandon Lowe with 21, Mike Zunino with 19, who's your catcher. Nobody on that. Let me see. By looking at the roster, there's really nobody on there who's over 31. You got Joey Wendell at third, and Kevin Kiermaier. Those are your veteran presences. I mean, okay, Rich Hill, the pitcher, but that doesn't count, quite frankly. But, yeah, it's a young-ish team. It's not a young team, but it's not an old veteran team either. So I think it makes a lot of sense to put – you know, we spent a good chunk of the show, Nate, talking about locker room presence and having somebody in there who's, you know, been there, for lack of a better phrase, maybe not necessarily – you know, consistently a champion, played in a lot of championships, but he's a guy I think that can go up to a player and say, listen, this is, you know, a good way to do things, or be that kind of person in the locker room. But really, I mean, he'll just move the players from first to second, second to third, and third to home. And that's, at the end of the day, the best thing you can do. I mean, the guy does still hit bombs, for whatever it's worth. I mean, that does fit. And I don't have any spray charts or anything, Nate, but I'd have to believe the Rays think he's going to hit well in that ballpark. But, Nate, can you tell me some things that you're thinking as we close the show and get closer to the trade deadline?
Yeah. Let's see, for the trade deadline, I think it's going to be interesting to see what, you know, we touched on it last week, and I think we touched on it the week before. and it's going to continue to be a thing. The Cubs and how the Cubs are going to keep going at this trade deadline and who all of the pieces are going to get sold off. I think I saw somewhere, now I don't know that how much of this is truth, how much of it is rumor, but I think I saw that Javi Baez is looking for a $200 million contract extension. And if that's true, that he's actually looking for that, as much as he's a fan favorite, I think it's time for him to go for, you know, everything that we talked about last week. He's getting old. He's getting older. You know, can the Cardinals catch fire here in the next week or two, or the next week rather, as we move into the trade deadline? Do they close that gap on the Brewers to the point where they become buyers instead of stand pat? You got a lot of teams that are just kind of like sitting right around 500. So who's actually buying?
Well,
who's actually selling it? Like, I'm not seeing a whole lot of movement right now.
The Reds would have to do something dramatic, I think, because Castellanos is hurt right now, and he'll be out for a few mm-hmm. weeks. So I think the Reds have to do something just to tread water. It would be a big blow to the roster, but I also think the Reds would have to trade away possibly a prized asset in order to bring somebody on, but then they bring somebody on to keep them where they are and then add Castellanos later. That would be really good. I'm honestly very curious if the Red Sox do something small. I don't think they'll do anything big, but I think they'll do a little tweak. And if they do exactly that, I think that'll be the best thing. I also think the Yankees, I don't know, man. It just always seems like they do something wild. I saw earlier Trevor Story, his name being linked to the Yankees, then moving Torres back to second, but who knows?
I mean, I told you I was waiting for the Yankees for their talent to come out. Now, it's been a week, but they're 7-3 in their last 10. They won 4 straight, and all of a sudden they're only – now they're 6 games over 500. They're only 7 games back of Boston. They're 6 games back of Tampa. I think the talent is floating to the top of the division as much as I hate it and as much as I'm annoyed by it.
You're falling into my trap, Nate. I told you this is fool's gold wins. Go look at how they're winning, and it's all fool's gold. It'll be just enough to make either the end of the season interesting and fighting for a playoff spot, or it will get them in the playoffs and save Boone another year. And they'll say, oh, see, look, they won, you know, 90-something games or something if they manage to find a way to beat up on teams the second half of the year and have a real major run as the temperatures are hot. I don't know.
I'm not putting you as a World Series favorite. I'm saying you're going to make the playoffs, or you're at least going to make it interesting in the playoffs, and you'll be buyers at the deadline.
Yeah, it's annoying. I think the Yankees should just reset, but whatever. That's just me being frustrated. I think you got to sell high, and this is a great time to sell high. But I also don't know who I'd be willing to sell. So,
well, I think we're about at the end of the show. So I'm going to go ahead and just throw out our trivia tidbit for the evening. On Tuesday, the Dodgers hit a walk-off home run to beat the Giants. Can you tell me who was the last Dodger to hit a walk-off home run against the Giants when the Dodgers were trailing?
Kirk Gibson? No. I don't know. Who?
Hall of Fame catcher Roy Campanella back in 1953.
Wow.
That's how long it took the Dodgers to hit a walk-off home run against the Giants.
That's terrifying.
It's time to go watch the Giants and the Dodgers game, and let's see Walker Buehler get tagged for 6 runs.
Oh, yeah, Nate. All right, Nate, I'm going to do my close here. But, guys, it's been a lot of fun. I have said enough for a lifetime, and for the last time, I wish you all a very pleasant good evening.
Sports City, Sports City, Chef, Sports City, Sports City, Chef, Sports City, Sports City, Chef, Sports City, Sports City, Chef. Kaboom, Sports City chefs is in the room, cooking up hot topics to put up on your spoon. They well in tune, bloom like a flower in June. Superman verse MF Doom, the clouds loom. So tell a friend, it's the Sports City chefs again.
Pay attention, tune in, we on a set again. Sports City, Chef, Chef. Sports City, Chef, Chef. Yeah. Cabbie. Taj.
Woo! Connecticut.